for yourself. I do not expect to have need of coin again. I told him as quietly. I did not explain that I no longer planned to have much to do with humans. I never wanted to explain myself again to anyone. I did not care if they understood me or not. I closed my eyes and groped out, to touch briefly with night eyes. Like me, he was hungry, but had chosen to rest instead. By tomorrow evening I shall be free to hunt with you again, I promised him. He sighed in satisfaction. He was not that far away. My fire was a spark through the trees below him. He rested his muzzle on his forepaws. I was wearier than I had realized. My thoughts drifted, blurred. I let it all go and floated free, away from the pains that niggled at my body. Molly, I thought wistfully. Molly. But I did not find her. Somewhere, Burridge slept on a pallet made up before a hearth. I saw him, and it felt almost as if I skilled him, but I could not hold the vision. The firelight illuminated the planes of his face. He was thinner, and burnt dark with hours of field work. I spun slowly away from him. The skill lapped against me, but I could find no control of it. When my dreams brushed up against patience, I was shocked to find her in a private chamber with Lord Bright. He looked like a cornered animal. A young woman in a lovely gown was evidently as startled as he to have Patience intrude on them. Patience was armed with a map, and she was speaking as she pushed aside a tray of dainties and wine to unfurl it on the table.
I have found you neither stupid nor craven, Lord Bright, so I must assume you are ignorant. I intend that your education shall no longer be neglected. As this map by the late Prince Verity will prove to you, if you do not take action soon, all the coast of Buck will be at the mercy of the Red Ships. And they have no mercy.
She lifted those piercing hazel eyes and stared at him as she had so often stared at me when she expected to be obeyed. I almost pitied him. I lost my feeble grip on the scene, like a leaf borne by the wind. I swirled away from them. I did not know if I next went higher or deeper, only that I felt all that bound me to my body was a tenuous thread. I turned and spun in a current that tugged at me, encouraging me to let go. Somewhere a wolf whined in anxiety. Ghostly fingers plucked at me, as if seeking my attention. Fitz, be careful, get back. Verity. But his skilling had no more force than a puff of wind, despite the effort I knew it cost him. Something was between us, a cold fog, yielding yet resisting, entangling like brambles. I tried to care, tried to find enough fear to send me fleeing back to my body, but it was like being trapped inside a dream and trying to awaken. I could not find a way to struggle out of it. I could not find the will to try. A whiff of dog magic stench in the air, and look what I find. Will, hooked into me like cat claws, drew me tight against him.
Hello, bastard.
His deep satisfaction reawakened every nuance of my fear. I could feel his cynical smile.
Neither of them dead, not the bastard with his perverted magic, nor Verity the pretender. Tisk, tisk. Regal will be chagrined to find he was not as successful as he had thought. This time, though, I shall make sure of things for him.
My way.
I felt an insidious probing of my defences, more intimate than a kiss. As if he needed a whore's flesh, he felt me over for weaknesses. I dangled like a rabbit in his grasp, waiting only for the twist and jerk that would end my life. I felt how he had grown in strength and cunning.
Verity, I whimpered,
but my king could neither hear nor respond. He weighed me in his grip.
What use to you this strength you have never learned to master? None at all, but to me, to me, it shall give wings and claws. You shall make me strong enough to seek out Verity no matter how he may hide himself.
Suddenly, I was leaking strength like a punctured water skin. I had no idea how he had penetrated my defenses and knew of no way to ward him off. He clutched my mind greedily to his and leeched at me. This was how Justin and Serene had killed King Shrewd. He had gone swiftly, like a bubble popping. I could find neither will nor strength to struggle, as will forced down all walls between us. His foreign thoughts were a pressure inside my mind as he scrabbled at my secrets, all the while drawing off my substance. But within me, a wolf was waiting for him.
"My brother,"
Night Eyes declared, and launched at him, tooth and nail. Somewhere in the vast distance, Will shrieked in horror and dismay. However strong he might be in the skill, he had no knowledge at all of the wit. He was as powerless before Night Eye's attack as I had been before his. Once, when Justin had skill attacked me, Night Eyes had responded. I had watched as Justin had gone down, just as if he were being physically savaged by a wolf. He had lost all concentration and control over his skill, and I had been able to break free of him. I could not see what was happening to Will, but I sensed Night Eye's snapping jaws. I was buffeted by the strength of Will's horror. He fled, breaking the skill link between us so suddenly that for a moment I was unsure of my identity. Then I was back, wide awake, inside my own body. I sat up on my blanket, sweat streaming down my back, and slammed up every wall about myself that I could remember how to erect.
"Cobb?"
Josh asked, in some alarm, and I saw him sit up sleepily. Honey was staring at me from her own blanket where she sat keeping watch. I choked back a panting sob.
"A nightmare,"
I managed huskily.
"Just a nightmare."
I staggered to my feet, horrified at how weakened I was. The world spun around me. I could barely stand. Fear of my own weakness spurred me. I caught up my small kettle and carried it off with me as I headed for the river. Elf bark tea, I promised myself, and hoped it would be potent enough. I veered wide of the heaped stones that covered the forged ones' bodies. Before I reached the bank of the river, Night Eyes was beside me, hitching along on three legs. I dropped my kettle and sank down beside him. I threw my arms around him, mindful of the slash on his shoulder, and buried my face in his ruff.
"I was so scared. I nearly died.
I understand now why we must kill them all,"
he said calmly.
"If we do not, they will never let us be. We must hunt them down to their own lair and kill them all."
It was the only comfort he could offer me. 6. The Wit and the Skill. Minstrels and wandering scribes hold special places in the society of the six duchies. They are repositories of knowledge, not only of their own crafts, but of so much more. The minstrels hold the histories of the six duchies, not just the general history that has shaped the kingdom, but the particular histories of the small towns and even the families who make them up. Although it is the dream of every minstrel to be sole witness to some great event and thus gain the authoring of a new saga, their true and lasting importance lies in their constant witnessing of the small events that make up life's fabric. When there is a question of a property line, or family lineage, or even of a long-term promise made, the minstrels are called upon to supply the details that others may have forgotten. Supporting them, but not supplanting them, are the wandering scribes. For a fee, they will provide written record of a wedding, a birth, a land changing hands, of inheritances gained, or dowries promised. Such records may be intricate things, for every party involved must be identified in a way that is unmistakable, not just by name and profession, but by lineage and location and appearance. As often as not, A minstrel is then called to make his mark as witness to what the scribe has written, and for this reason, it is not unusual to find them travelling in company together, or for one person to profess both trades. Minstrels and scribes are by custom well treated in the noble houses, finding their winter quarters there, and sustenance and comfort in old age. No lord wishes to be ill-remembered in the tellings of minstrels and scribes, or worse yet, not remembered at all. Generosity to them is taught as simple courtesy. One knows when one is in the presence of a miser, when one sits at table in a keep, that boasts no minstrels. I bid the musicians farewell at the door of an inn in a shoddy little town called Crowsneck the next afternoon. Rather, I bid Josh farewell. Honey stalked into the inn without a backward glance at me. Piper did look at me, but the look was so puzzled that it conveyed nothing to me. Then she followed Honey in. Josh and I were left standing in the street. We had been walking together, and his hand was still on my shoulder. Bit of a step here at the inn door, I warned Josh quietly. He nodded his thanks.
Well, some hot food will be welcome, he observed,
and pushed his chin toward the door. I shook my head, then spoke my refusal. Thank you, but I won't be going in with you. I'm moving on.
Right now? Come, Cobb, at least have a mug of beer and a bite to eat. I know that Honey is difficult to tolerate sometimes, but you needn't assume she speaks for all of us.
It's not that. I simply have something that I must do. Something I've put off for a long, long time. Yesterday I realized that, until I have done it, there will be no peace for me. Josh sighed heavily.
Yesterday was an ugly day. I would not base any life decision on it.
He swung his head to look toward me.
Whatever it is, Cobb, I think time will make it better. It does most things, you know.
Some things, I muttered distractedly.
Other things don't get better until you
mend them, one way or another.
Well,
he hitched out his hand to me, and I took it.
Good luck to you, then. At least this fighter's hand has a sword to grip now. That can't be bad fortune for you.
Here's the door, I said, and opened it for him.
Good luck to you as well,
I told him as he passed me, and closed it behind him. As I stepped out into the open street again, I felt as if I had tossed a burden aside.
Free again.
I would not soon weigh myself down with anything like that again.
I'm coming, I told Night Eyes. This evening we hunt. I'll be watching for you.
I hitched my bundle a bit higher on my shoulder, took a fresh grip on my staff, and strode down the street. I could think of nothing in Crowsneck that I could possibly desire. My path took me straight through the market square, however, and the habits of a lifetime die hard. My ears pricked up to the grumbles and complaints of those who had come to bargain. Buyers demanded to know why prices were so high. Sellers replied that the trade from downriver was scarce, and whatever goods came upriver as far as Crowsneck were dear. Prices were worse upriver, they assured them. For all those who complained about the high prices, there were as many who came looking for what was simply not there. It was not just the ocean fish and the thick wool of buck that no longer came up the river. It was as Chade had predicted. There were no silks, no brandies, no fine Bingtown gemwork, nothing from the coastal duchies, nor from the lands beyond. Regal's attempt to strangle the Mountain Kingdom's trade routes had also deprived the Crowsneck merchants of mountain amber and furs and other goods. Crowsneck had been a trading town. Now it was stagnant, choking on a surplus of its own goods and naught to trade them for. At least one shambling drunk knew where to put the blame. He wove his way through the market, caroming off stalls and staggering through the wares lesser merchants had displayed on mats. His shaggy black hair hung to his shoulders and merged with his beard. He sang as he came, or growled, more truly, for his voice was louder than it was musical. There was little melody to fix the tune in my mind, and he botched whatever rhyme had once been to the song, but the sense of it was clear. When Shrewd had been king of the six duchies, the river had run with gold, but now that Regal wore the crown, the coasts all ran with blood. There was a second verse, saying it was better to pay taxes to fight the red ships than pay them to a king that hid. But that one was interrupted by the arrival of the city guard. There were a pair of them, and I expected to see them halt the drunk and shake him down for coins to pay for whatever he'd broken. I should have been forewarned by the silence that came over the market when the guards appeared. Commerce ceased. Folk melted out of the way or pressed back against the stalls to allow them passage. All eyes followed and fixed on them. They closed on the drunk swiftly, and I was one of the silent crowd watching as they seized him. The drunk goggled at them in dismay, and the look of appeal he swept over the crowd was chilling in its intensity. Then one of the guards drew back a gauntleted fist and sank it into his belly. The drunk looked to be a tough man gone paunchy in the way that some thickly set men do as they age. A soft man would have collapsed at that blow. He curled himself forward over the guard's fist, his breath whistling out, and then abruptly spewed out a gush of soured ale. The guard stepped back in distaste, one giving the drunk a shove that sent him tottering off balance. He crashed against a market stall, sending two baskets of eggs splatting into the dirt. The egg merchant said nothing, only stepped back deeper into his stall, as if he did not wish to be noticed at all. The guards advanced on the unfortunate man. The first one there gripped him by the shirt front and dragged him to his feet. He struck him a short, straight blow to the face that sent him crashing into the other guard's arms. That one caught him, and held him up for his partner's fist to find his belly again. This time, the drunk dropped to his knees, and the guard behind him casually kicked him down. I did not realize I had started forward until a hand caught at my shoulder. I looked back into the wizened face of a gaunt old woman who clutched at me. "Don't make them mad," she breathed. "They'll let him off with a beating. If no one makes them angry, make them angry and they'll kill him, or worse. Take him off for the king's circle." I locked eyes with her weary gaze, and she looked down as if ashamed. But she did not take her hand from my shoulder. Like her, then, I looked aside from what they did and tried not to hear the impacts on flesh, the grunts and strangled cries of the beaten man. The day was hot, and the guards wore more mail than I was accustomed to seeing on city guards. Perhaps that was what saved the drunk. No one likes to sweat in armor. I looked back in time to see one stoop and cut loose the man's purse, heft it, and then pocket it. The other guard looked about at the crowd as he announced, "Black Rolf has been fined and punished for the treasonous act of making mock of the king. Let it be an example to all." The guards left him lying in the dirt and litter of the market square, and continued their rounds. One guard watched over his shoulder as they strode away, but no one moved until they turned a corner. Then, gradually, the market stirred back to life. The old woman lifted her hand from my shoulder and turned back to haggling for turnips. The egg merchant came around the front of his stall to stoop and gather the few unbroken eggs and the yolky baskets. No one looked directly at the fallen man. I stood, for a time, waiting for a shaky coldness inside me to fade. I wanted to ask why city guards should care about a drunkard's song, but no one met my querying glance. I suddenly had even less use for anyone or anything in Crow's Neck. I hitched my pack a notch higher and resumed my trek out of town. But as I drew near the groaning man, his pain lapped against me. The closer I came, the more distinct it was, almost like forcing my hand deeper and deeper into a fire. He lifted his face to stare at me. Dirt clung to the blood and vomit on it. I tried to keep walking.
Help him.
My mind rendered thus the sudden mental urging I felt. I halted as I knifed, nearly reeling. The plea was not from Night Eyes. The drunk got a hand under himself and levered himself higher. His eyes met mine in dumb appeal and misery. I had seen such eyes before. They were those of an animal, in pain.
Maybe we should help him?
Night Eyes asked uncertainly.
Hush,
I warned him.
Please, help him.
The plea had grown in urgency and strength.
Old blood asks of old blood.
The voice in my mind spoke more clearly, not in words but images. I witted the meaning behind it. It was a laying on of clan obligation.
Are they back with us?
Night Eyes asked wonderingly. I knew he could sense my confusion and did not reply. Black Rolf had managed to get his other hand under himself. He pushed himself up onto one knee, then mutely extended a hand to me. I clasped his forearm and drew him slowly to his feet. Once he was upright, he swayed slightly. I kept hold of his arm and let him catch his balance against me. As dumb as he, I offered him my walking staff. He took it, but did not relinquish my arm. Slowly, we left the marketplace, the drunk leaning on me heavily. Entirely too many people stared after us curiously. As we walked through the streets, people glanced up at us, and then away. The man said nothing to me. I kept expecting him to point out some direction he wished to go, some house claimed as his. But he said nothing. As we reached the outskirts of town, the road meandered down the riverbank. The sun shone through an opening in the trees, glinting silver on the water. Here a shoal of the river swept up against a grassy bank framed by willow woods. Some folk carrying baskets of wet washing were just leaving. He gave me a slight tug on the arm to indicate he wished to get to the river's edge. Once there, Black Rolf sank to his knees, then leaned forward to plunge not just his face, but his entire head and neck into the water. He came up, rubbed his face with his hands, and then ducked himself again. The second time he came up, he shook his head as vigorously as a wet dog, sending water spraying in all directions. He sat back on his heels and looked up at me, blearily.
"A drink too much when I come to town,"
he said hollowly. I nodded to that.
"Will you be all right now?"
He nodded back. I could see his tongue move inside his mouth, checking for cuts and loose teeth. The memory of old pain rolled over restlessly inside me. I wanted to be away from any reminders of that. "Good luck, then," I told him. I stooped upstream of him and drank and refilled my water skin. Then I rose, hefted my pack again, and turned to leave. A prickling of the wit swiveled my head suddenly toward the woods. A stump shifted, then suddenly reared up as a brown bear.
She snuffed the air, then dropped to all fours again and shambled toward us.
"Rolf?" I said quietly, as I started to slowly back up. "Rolf? There's a bear."
"She's mine," he said as quietly. "You've nothing to fear from her."
I stood stock still as she shuffled out of the woods and down the grassy bank. As she drew close to Rolf, she gave a low cry, oddly like a cow's bawl for her calf. Then she nudged her big head against him. He stood up, leaning a hand on her sloping front shoulders to do so. I could sense them communicating with one another, but had no notion of their messages. Then she lifted her head to look directly at me.
old blood.
She acknowledged me. Her little eyes were deep set above her muzzle. As she walked, the sunlight sleeked her glossy, rolling hide. They both came toward me. I did not move. When they were very close, she lifted her nose and pressed her snout firmly against me, and began to take long snuffs.
My brother?
Night Eyes queried in some alarm. I think it is all right. I scarcely dared to breathe. I had never been this close to a live bear. Her head was the size of a bushel basket. Her hot breath against my chest reeked of river fish. After a moment, she stepped away from me, huffing an ah-ah-ah sound in her throat, as if considering all she had scented on me. She sat back on her haunches, taking air in through her open mouth as if tasting my scent on it. She wagged her head slowly from side to side, then seemed to reach a decision. She dropped to all fours again and trundled off.
Come,
Rolf said briefly, and motioned me to follow. They set off toward the woods. Over his shoulder, he added,
We have food to share. The wolf is welcome, too.
After a moment, I set out after them.
Is this wise?
I could sense that Night Eyes was not far away and was moving toward me as swiftly as he could, eeling between trees as he came down a hillside. I need to understand what they are. Are they like us? I have never spoken to any like us. A derisive snort from Night Eyes.
You were raised by Heart of the Pack. He is more like us than these. I am not certain I wish to come close to a bear, or to the man who thinks with the bear.
I want to know more, I insisted.
How did she sense me? How did she reach out to me?
Despite my curiosity, I stayed well back from the strange twosome. Man and bear shambled along ahead of me. They wended their way through the willow woods beside the river, avoiding the road. At a place where the forest drew densely down to the opposite side of the road, they crossed, hastily. I followed. In the deeper shadow of these larger trees, we soon struck a game trail that cut across the face of a hill. I sensed Night Eyes before he materialized beside me. He was panting from his haste. My heart smote me at how he moved on three legs. Too often he had taken injuries on my behalf. What right did I have to ask that of him?
It is not as bad as all that.
He did not like to walk behind me, but the trail was too narrow for both of us. I ceded him the path and walked alongside, dodging branches and trunks, closely watching our guides. Neither of us were easy about that bear. A single swipe from one of her paws could cripple or kill, and my small experience of bears did not indicate they had even temperaments. Walking in the flow of her scent kept Night Eyes' hackles erect, and my skin a prickle. In time we came to a small cabin set snug against the side of the hill. It was made of stone and log, chinked with moss and earth. The logs that roofed it were overlaid with turf. Grasses and even small bushes sprouted from the roof of the cabin. The door was unusually wide and gaped open. Both man and bear preceded us inside. After a moment of hesitation, I ventured near to peer inside. Night Eyes hung back, hackles half raised, ears pricked forward. Black Rolf stepped back to the door to look out at us.
Come in and be welcome, he offered.
When he saw that I hesitated, he added,
Old blood does not turn on old blood.
Slowly, I entered. There was a low slab table in the center of the room, with a bench to either side of it, and a river rock hearth in a corner between two large, comfortable chairs. Another door led to a smaller sleeping room. The cabin smelled like a bear's den, rank and earthy. In one corner was a scattering of bones, and the walls there bore the marks of claws. A woman was just setting aside a broom after sweeping the dirt floor. She was dressed in brown, and her short brown hair was sleeked to her head like an acorn's cap. She turned her head quickly toward me and fixed me with an unblinking stare from brown eyes. Rolf gestured toward me.
"Here are the guests I was telling you about, Holly,"
he announced. "I thank you for your hospitality," I said. She looked almost startled.
"Old blood always welcomes old blood," she asserted.
I brought my eyes back to confront the glittering blackness of Rolf's gaze. "I have never heard of this old blood before," I ventured.
"But you know what it is."
He smiled at me, and it seemed a bear's smile. He had the bear's posture, his lumbering walk, a way of slowly wagging his head from side to side, of tucking his chin and looking down as if a muzzle divided his eyes. Behind him, his woman slowly nodded. She lifted her eyes and exchanged a glance with someone. I followed her gaze to a small hawk perched on a cross rafter. His eyes bored into me. The beams were streaked white with his droppings.
"You mean the wit?" I asked.
"No. So it is named by those who have no knowing of it. That is the name it is despised by. Those of us who are of the old blood do not name it so."
He turned away to a cupboard set against the stout wall and began to take food from it. Long, thick slabs of smoked salmon. A loaf of bread heavy with nuts and fruit baked into it. The bear rose on her hind legs, then dropped again to all fours, snuffing appreciatively. She turned her head sideways to take a side of fish from the table. It looked small in her jaws. She lumbered off to a corner with it and turned her back as she began on it. The woman had silently positioned herself on a chair from which she could watch the whole room. When I glanced at her, she smiled and motioned her own invitation to the table. Then she resumed her stillness and her watching. I found my own mouth watering at the sight of the food. It had been days since I had eaten to repletion, and I'd had almost nothing in the last 2 days. A light whine from outside the cottage reminded me that Night Eyes was in the same condition.
"No cheese, no butter."
Black Rolf warned me solemnly.
"The city guard took all the coin I'd traded for before I got around to buying butter and cheese, but we fish and bread in plenty, and honeycomb for the bread. Take what you wish."
Almost inadvertently, my eyes flickered toward the door.
"Both of you,"
he clarified for me.
"Among the old blood, two are treated as one, always."
"Sleet and I welcome you as well,"
the woman added softly.
"I am Holly."
I nodded gratefully to her invitation and reached for my wolf. "Night Eyes, will you come in?"
"I will come to the door."
A moment later, a grey shadow slunk past the door opening. I sensed him prowling about outside the cabin, taking up the scents of the place, registering bear over and over. He passed the door again, peered in briefly, then made another circuit of the cabin. He discovered a partially devoured carcass of a deer, with leaves and dirt scruffed over it, not too far from the cabin. It was a typical bear's cache. I did not need to warn him to leave it alone. Finally, he came back to the door and settled before it, sitting alertly. Ears pricked.
"Take food to him if he does not wish to come inside,"
Rolf urged me. He added,
"None of us believes in forcing a fellow against his natural instincts."
"Thank you," I said a bit stiffly, but I did not know what manners were called for here. I took a slab of the salmon from the table. I tossed it to Night Eyes, and he caught it deftly. For a moment, he sat with it in his jaws. He could not both eat and remain totally wary. Long strings of saliva began to trail from his mouth as he sat there gripping the fish.
"Eat," I urged him. "I do not think they wish us any harm."
He needed no more urging than that. He dropped the fish, pinned it to the ground with his forepaw, and then tore off a large hunk of it. He wolfed it down, scarcely chewing. His eating awoke my hunger with an intensity I'd been suppressing. I looked away from him to find that Black Rolf had cut me a thick slab of the bread and slathered it with honey. He was pouring a large mug of mead for himself. Mine was already beside my plate.
"Eat! Don't wait for me!"
he invited me. And when I looked askance at the woman, she smiled.
"Be welcome,"
she said quietly. She came to the table and took a platter for herself, but put only a small portion of fish and a fragment of bread on it. I sensed she did so to put me at ease, rather than for her own hunger.
"Eat well,"
she bade me, and added,
"We can sense your hunger, you know."
She did not join us at table, but carried her food off to her chair by the hearth. I was only too glad to obey her. I ate with much the same manners as Nighteyes. He was on his third slab of salmon, and I had finished as many pieces of bread and was eating a second piece of salmon before I recalled myself to my host. Rolf refilled my mug with mead and observed,
"I once tried to keep a goat, for milk and cheese and such, but she never could become accustomed to Hilda. Poor thing was always too nervous to let down her milk, so we have mead. With Hilda's nose for honey, that's a drink we can supply ourselves with."
"It's wonderful," I sighed. I set down my mug, a quarter drained already, and breathed out. I hadn't finished eating, but the urgent edge of my hunger was gone now. Black Rolf picked up another slab of fish from the table and tossed it casually to Hilda. She caught it, paws and jaws, then turned aside from us to resume eating. He sent another slab winging to Nighteyes, who had lost all wariness. He leaped for it, then lay down, the salmon between his front paws, and turned his head to scissor off chunks and gulp them down. Holly picked at her food, tearing off small strips of dried fish and ducking her head as she ate them. Every time I glanced her way, I found her looking at me with sharp black eyes. I looked back at Hilda. "How did you ever come to bond with a she-bear?" I asked, and then added, if it isn't a rude question, "I've never spoken to anyone else who was bonded to an animal, at least no one who admitted it openly." He leaned back in his chair and rested his hands upon his belly.
"I don't admit it openly to just anyone. I suppose that you knew of me right away, as Hilda and I are always aware when there are others of the old blood nearby. But as to your question, my mother was old blood, and two of her children inherited it. She sensed it in us, of course, and raised us in the ways. And when I was of an age, as a man, I made my quest."
I looked at him blankly. He shook his head, a pitying smile touching his lips.
"I went out alone, out into the world, seeking my companion beast. Some look in the towns, some look in the forest, a few, I have heard tell, even go out to sea. But I was drawn to the woods. So I went out alone, senses wide, fasting save for cold water and the herbs that quicken the old blood. I found a place here, and I sat down among the roots of an old tree, and I waited. And in time, Hilda came to me, seeking just as I had been seeking. We tested one another and found the trust, and, well, here we are, 7 years later."
He glanced at Hilda as fondly as if he spoke of a wife and children. "A deliberate search for one to bond with," I mused.
"I believe that you sought me that day, and that I called out for you, though neither of us knew at the time what we were seeking,"
Nighteyes mused, putting my rescuing him from the animal trader in a new light. "I do not think so," I told him regretfully. I had bonded twice before with dogs, and had learned too well the pain of losing such a companion. I had resolved never to bond again. Rolf was looking at me with disbelief, almost horror.
"You had bonded twice before the wolf, and lost both companions?"
He shook his head, denying it could be so.
"You are very young.
even for a first bonding.
I shrugged at him. I was just a child when Nosey and I joined. He was taken away from me by one who knew something of bonding and did not think it was good for either of us. Later I did encounter him again, but it was at the end of his days. And the other pup I bonded to. Rolf was regarding me with a distaste as fervent as Burridge's was for the wit, while Holly silently shook her head.
You bonded as a child?
Forgive me, but that is perversion. As well allow a little girl to be wed off to a grown man, a child is not ready to share the full life of a beast. All old-blood parents I know most carefully shelter their children from such contacts.
Sympathy touched his face.
Still, it must have been excruciating for your bond friend to be taken from you. But whoever did it did the right thing, whatever his reason.
He looked at me more closely.
I am surprised you survived,
knowing nothing of the old blood ways.
Where I come from it is seldom spoken of, and when it is called the wit, and is deemed a shameful thing to do.
Even your parents told you this? For while I well know how the old blood is regarded and all the lies that are told about it, one usually does not hear them from one's own parents. Our parents cherish our lines and help us to find proper mates when the time comes, so that our blood may not be thinned.
I glanced from his frank gaze to Holly's open stare. I did not know my parents. Even anonymously, the words did not come easily from me. My mother gave me over to my father's family when I was 6 years old, and my father chose not to be near me. Still, I suspect the old blood came from my mother's side. I recall nothing of her or her family.
6 years old?
And you recall nothing? Surely she taught you something before she let you go, gave you some knowledge to protect yourself?
I sighed.
I recall nothing of her.
I had long ago grown weary of folk telling me that I must remember something of her, that most people have memories that go back to when they were 3, or even younger. Black Rolf made a low noise in his throat, between a growl and a sigh.
Well, someone taught you something.
No. I said it flatly, tired of the argument. I wished an end to it, and so resorted to the oldest tactic I knew for diverting people when they asked too many questions about me.
Tell me about yourself, I urged him. What did your mother teach you, and how?
He smiled, his cheeks wrinkling flatly about his black eyes and making them smaller.
It took her 20 years to teach it to me.
Have you that long to hear about it?
At my look, he added,
No, I know you ask but to make conversation. But I offer what I see you needing.
Stay with us a bit. We'll teach you what you both need to know, but you won't learn it in an hour or a day. It's going to take months.
Perhaps years.
Holly spoke suddenly from the corner in a quiet voice.
We could find him a mate as well. He might do for Ollie's girl. She's older, but she might steady him down.
Rolf grinned widely.
Isn't that like a woman? Knows you for 5 minutes and already matching you up for marriage.
Holly spoke directly to me. Her smile was small, but warm.
Vita is bonded to a crow. All of you would hunt well together. Stay with us. You will meet her and like her. Old blood should join to old blood. Refuse politely.
Night Eyes suggested immediately.
Bad enough to den among men. If you start sleeping near bears, you shall stink so that we can never hunt well again. Nor do I desire to share our kills with a teasing crow.
He paused.
Unless they know of a woman who is bonded with a bitch wolf.
A smile twitched at the corner of Black Rolf's mouth. I suspected he was more aware of what we said than he let on, and I told Night Eyes as much.
It is one of the things that I could teach you, should you choose to stay.
Rolf offered. When you two speak to one of the old blood, it is as if you were shouting to one another over the rattle of a tinker's cart. There is no need to be so wide open with it. It is only one wolf you address, not all of the wolf kindred. No, it is even more than that. I doubt if anything that eats meat is unaware of you two. Tell me, when was the last time you encountered a large carnivore?
Dogs chased me some nights ago,
Night Eyes said. Dogs will stand and bark from their territory, Rolf observed. I meant a wild carnivore. I don't think I've seen any since we bonded, I admitted unwillingly. They will avoid you as surely as forged ones will follow you, Black Rolf said calmly. A chill went down my spine. Forged ones? But forged ones seem to have no wit at all. I do not sense them with my wit sense at all, only with eyes or nose or...
To your old blood senses, all creatures give off a kinship warmth. All save the forged ones, this is true.
I nodded uneasily.
They have lost it. I do not know how it is stolen from them, but that is what forging does, and it leaves an emptiness in them. This much is well known among those of the old blood, and we know, too, that we are more likely to be followed and attacked by forged ones, especially if we use those talents carelessly. Why this is so, no one can say with certainty. Perhaps only forged ones know if they truly know anything any more, but it gives us one more reason to be cautious of ourselves and our talents.
Are you suggesting that Night Eyes and I should refrain from using the wit?
I am suggesting that perhaps you should stay here for a while and take the time to learn to master the talents of the old blood. Or you may find yourself in more battles such as the one you fought yesterday.
He permitted himself a small smile.
I said nothing to you of that attack, I said quietly.
You did not need to,
he pointed out.
I am sure that everyone of old blood for leagues around heard you when you fought them. Until you both learn to control how you speak to one another, nothing between you is truly private.
He paused, then added,
Did you never think it strange that forged ones would spend time attacking a wolf when there is apparently nothing to gain from such an attack? They only focus on him because he is bonded to you.
I gave Night Eyes a brief, apologetic glance. I thank you for your offer, but we have a thing we must do, and it will not wait. I think that we shall encounter fewer forged ones as we move inland. We should be fine.
That is likely. The ones that go so far inland are gathered up by the king. Still, any that may be left will be drawn to you. But even if you encounter no more forged ones, you are likely to encounter the king's guards. They take a special interest in witted folk these days. Of late, many of the old blood have been sold to the king by neighbors, and even family. His gold is good, and he does not even ask much proof that they are truly old blood. Not for years has the vendetta against us burned so hot.
I looked away uncomfortably, well aware of why Regal hated those with the wit. His coterie would support him in that hate. I felt sickened at the thought of innocent folk sold to Regal that he might revenge himself on them in my stead. I tried to keep the rage I felt masked. Hilda came back to the table, looked it over consideringly, then seized the pot that held the honeycombs in both her paws. She waddled carefully away from the table to seat herself in the corner and begin a careful licking out of the pot. Holly continued to watch me. I could read nothing from her eyes. Black Rolf scratched at his beard, then winced as his fingers found a sore spot. He smiled a careful, rueful smile at me.
I can sympathize with your desire to kill King Regal, but I do not think you shall find it as easy as you suppose.
I just looked at him. But Night Eyes rolled a light snarl in the back of his throat. Hilda looked up at that and thumped down on all fours, the honey jar rolling away from her across the floor. Black Rolf sent her a glance and she sat back, but fixed both Night Eyes and me with a glare. I don't think there is anything as gut-tightening as an angry glare from a brown bear. I did not move. Holly sat up straight in her chair but remained calm. Above us, in the rafters, sleet rattled his plumage.
If you bay out all your plans and grievances to the night moon, you cannot be astonished that others know of them. I do not think you shall encounter many of the old blood who are sympathetic to King Regal or any, perhaps. In fact, many would be willing to aid you if you asked them. Still, silence is wisest for a plan such as that.
From your song earlier, I would suspect you share my sentiments, I said quietly. And I thank you for your warning. But Night Eyes and I have had to be circumspect before about what we shared with one another. Now we know there is a danger of being overheard, I think we can compensate for it. One question I will ask of you. What care the city guard of Crow's Neck if a man has a few drinks and sings a mocking song about the king? I had to force the word from my throat.
None at all, when they are Crow's Neck men. But that is no longer the case in Crow's Neck, nor in any of the River Road towns. These are King's guards in the livery of the Crow's Neck guard and paid from the town purse, but King's men, all the same. Regal had not been king 2 months before he declared that change. He claimed the law would be enforced more equitably if city guards were all sworn king's men, carrying out the law of the 6 duchies above any other.
Well,
you have seen how they carry it out. Mostly by carrying off whatever they can from any poor sot who treads upon the king's toes. Still, those two in Crow's Neck are not so bad as some I've heard of. Word is that down in Sandbend a cutpurse or thief can make an easy living so long as the guard gets a share. The town masters are powerless to dismiss the guards the king has appointed, nor are they allowed to supplement them with their own men.
It sounded only too much like Regal. I wondered how obsessed he would become with power and control. Would he set spies upon his spies? Or had he already done so? None of it boded well for the 6 duchies as a whole. Black Rolf broke me from my musings.
Now, I've a question I would ask of you.
Be free to ask. I invited him, but held to myself how freely I should answer.
Last night, after you had finished with the Forged Ones, another attacked you. I could not sense who, only that your wolf defended you, and that he somehow went somewhere, that he threw his strength into a channel I did not understand nor could follow. I know no more than that he and you were victorious. What was that thing?
A servant of the king. I hedged. I did not wish to entirely refuse him an answer, and this seemed harmless, as he seemed to already know it.
You fought with what they call the skill, didn't you?
His eyes locked with mine. When I did not answer, he went on anyway.
There are many of us who would like to know how it was done. In our past, skilled ones have hunted us down as if we were vermin. No one of the old blood can say that his family has not suffered at their hands. Now these days have come again. If there is a way to use the talents of the old blood against those who wield the Farseer's skill, it is knowledge worth much to us.
Holly sidled from the corner, then came to grip the back of Rolf's chair and peer over his shoulder at me. I sensed the importance of my answer to them.
I cannot teach you that,
I said honestly. His eyes held mine, his disbelief plain.
Twice tonight, I have offered to teach you all I know of the old blood, to open to you all the doors that only your ignorance keep closed. You have refused me, but by Ida I have offered, and freely. But this one thing I ask, this one thing that might save so many lives of our own kind, you say you cannot teach me?
my eyes flickered to Hilda. Her eyes had gone beady and bright again. Black Rolf was probably unaware how his posture mimicked that of his bear. They both had me measuring the distance to the door, while Night Eyes was already on his feet and ready to flee. Behind Rolf, Holly cocked her head and stared at me. Above us, the hawk turned his head to watch us. I forced myself to loosen my muscles to behave much more calmly than I felt. It was a tactic learned from Burrich when confronting any distressed animal. "I speak truth to you," I said carefully. "I cannot teach you what I do not fully understand myself." I refrained from mentioning that I myself carried that despised Farseer blood. I was sure now of what I had only suspected before. The wit could be used to attack a skilled one only if a skilled channel had been opened between them. Even if I had been able to describe what Night Eyes and I had done, no one else would have been able to copy it. To fight the skill with the wit, one had to possess both the skill and the wit. I met Black Rolf's eyes calmly, knowing I had spoken the truth to him. Slowly he relaxed his hunched shoulders, and Hilda dropped back to all fours and went snuffling after the trailing honey. "Perhaps," he said, quietly stubborn. "Perhaps if you stayed with us and learned what I have to teach you, you would begin to understand what you do. Then you could teach it to me. Do you think so?" I kept my voice calm and even. "You witnessed one of the king's servants attack me last night. Do you think they will suffer me to remain here and learn more to use against them?" "No. My only chance is to beard them in their den before they come seeking me out." I hesitated, then offered. "Although I cannot teach you to do as I do, you may be assured that it will be used against the enemies of the old blood." This, finally, was a reasoning he could accept. He snuffed several times, thoughtfully. I wondered, uncomfortably, if I had as many wolf mannerisms as he had bear, and Holly had hawk.
"Will you stay the night, at least?"
he asked abruptly. "We do better when we travel by night," I said regretfully. "It is more comfortable for both of us." He nodded sagely to that.
"Well, I wish you well and every good fortune in achieving your end. You are welcome to rest safely here until the moon rises, if you wish."
I conferred with Night Eyes, and we accepted gratefully. I checked the slash on Night Eyes' shoulder and found it to be no better than I had suspected. I treated it with some of Burrich's salve, and then we sprawled outside in the shade and napped the afternoon away. It was good for both of us to be able to relax completely, knowing that others stood guard over us. It was the best sleep either of us had had since we had begun our journey. When we awoke, I found that Black Rolf had put up fish, honey, and bread for us to carry with us. There was no sign of the hawk. I imagined he had gone to roost for the night. Holly stood in the shadows near the house, regarding us sleepily.
"Go carefully. Go gently,"
Rolf counseled us, after we had thanked him and packed his gifts.
"Walk in the ways Ida has opened for you."
He paused, as if waiting for a response. I sensed a custom I was not familiar with. I wished him simply, "Good luck." And he nodded to that.
"You will be back, you know,"
he added. I shook my head slowly. "I doubt that. But I thank you for what you have given me."
"No. I know you will be back. It is not a matter of your wanting what I can teach you. You will find you need it. You are not a man as ordinary men are. They think they have a right to all beasts, to hunt them and eat them, or to subjugate them and rule their lives. You know you have no such right to mastery. The horse that carries you will do so because he wishes to, as does the wolf that hunts beside you. You have a deeper sense of yourself in the world. You believe you have a right not to rule it, but to be part of it.
predator or prey, there is no shame to being either one. As time goes on, you will find you have urgent questions. What must you do when your friend wishes to run with a pack of true wolves? I promise you that time will come. What must he do if you marry and have a child? When the time comes for one of you to die, as it must, how does the other make room for what is left, and carry on alone? In time you will hunger for others of your kind. You will need to know how to sense them and how to seek them out. There are answers to these questions, old blood answers, ones I cannot tell you in a day, ones you cannot understand in a week. You need those answers. And you will come back for them. I looked down at the trodden soil of the forest path. I had lost all certainty that I would not return to Rolf. Holly spoke softly but clearly from the shadows.
I believe in what you go to do. I wish you success, and would aid you if I could.
Her eyes darted to Rolf, as if this were a thing they had discussed but had not agreed upon.
If you are in need, cry out as you do to Night Eyes, asking that any of old blood who hear you pass word back to Holly and Sleet of Crow's Neck. Those who hear may come to your help, even if they do not. They will send word to me, and I will do what I can.
Rolf let out a sudden huff of breath.
We will do what we can,
he amended her words.
But you would be wiser to stay here and learn first how to better protect yourself.
I nodded to his words, but resolved privately that I would not involve any of them in my revenge against Regal. When I glanced up at Rolf, he smiled at me wryly and shrugged his shoulders.
Go then. But be wary, both of you. Before the moon goes down, you'll leave Buck behind and be in Farrow. If you think King Regal has a grip on us here, wait until you get to where folk believe he has a right to it.
I nodded grimly to that. And once more, Night Eyes and I were on our way. 7. Farrow. Lady Patience, the Lady of Buckkeep as she came to be called, rose to power in a unique fashion. She had been born into a noble family and was by birth a lady. She was raised to the loftier status of queen-in-waiting by her precipitous marriage to king-in-waiting chivalry. She never asserted herself in either position to take the power that birth and marriage had brought to her. It was only when she was alone, almost abandoned as eccentric Lady Patience at Buckkeep, that she gathered to herself the reins of influence. She did it, as she had done everything else in her life, in a haphazard, quaint way that would have availed any other woman not at all. She did not call on noble family connections or exert influential connections based on her deceased husband's status. Instead, she began with that lowest tier of power, the so-called men-at-arms, who were just as frequently women. Those few remaining of King Shrewd's personal guard and Queen Ketrican's guard had been left in the peculiar position of guardians with nothing left to guard. The Buckkeep guard had been supplanted in their duties by the personal troops that Lord Bright brought with him from Farrow, and delegated to lesser tasks that involved the cleaning and maintenance of the keep. The former guards were erratically paid, had lost respect among and for themselves, and were too often idle or occupied with denigrating tasks. The Lady Patience, ostensibly because they were not otherwise busied, began to solicit their services. She began by requesting a guard when she abruptly began to ride out on her ancient palfrey, Silk. Afternoon rides gradually lengthened to all-day forays, and then to overnight visits to villages that had either been raided or feared raids. In the raided villages, she and her maid Lacey did what they could for the injured, logged down a tally of those slain or forged, and provided, in the form of her guard, strong backs to aid in the clearing of rubble from the main streets, and the raising of temporary shelter for folk left homeless. This, while not true work for fighters, was a sharp reminder of what they had been trained to fight against, and of what happened, when there were no defenders. The gratitude of the folk they aided restored to the guard their pride and inner cohesiveness. In the unraided villages, the guard were a small show of force that Buckkeep and the Farseer pride still existed. In several villages and towns, makeshift stockades were raised where the folk could retreat from the raiders and have a small chance of defending themselves. There is no record of Lord Bright's feelings regarding Lady Patience's forays. She never declared these expeditions in any official way. They were her pleasure rides. The guards that accompanied her had volunteered to do so, and likewise for the duties she put them to in the villages. Some, as she came to trust them, ran errands for her. Such errands might involve the distance carrying of messages to keeps in Ripon, Bairns, and even Shokes, requesting news of how the coastal towns fared, and giving news of Buck. They took her runners into and through occupied territories, and were fraught with danger. Her messengers often were given a sprig of the ivy she grew year-round in her rooms as a token to present to the recipients of her messages and support. Several ballads have been written about the so-called ivy runners, telling of the bravery and resourcefulness they showed, and reminding us that even the greatest walls must, in time, yield to the over-climbing ivy. Perhaps the most famous exploit was that of Pansy, the youngest runner. At the age of 11, she travelled all the way to where the Duchess of Bairns was in hiding, in the ice caves of Bairns, to bring her tidings of when and where a supply boat would beach. For part of that journey, Pansy travelled undiscovered amidst the sacks of grain in a wagon commandeered by the raiders. From the very heart of a raider's camp, she escaped to continue her mission. But only after she had set fire to the tent in which their leader slept, in revenge for her forged parents. Pansy did not live to be 13, but her deeds will be long remembered. Others aided Patience in disposing of her jewellery and ancestral lands for coin, which she then employed as she pleased, as was her right, as she once informed Lord Bright. She bought grain and sheep from inland, and again her volunteers saw to its transport and distribution. Small supply boats brought hope to embattled defenders. She made token payments to stonemasons and carpenters who helped to rebuild ravaged villages, and she gave coin, not much, but accompanied by her scarcest thanks, to those guards who volunteered to assist her. By the time the ivy badge came into common usage among the Buckkeep guard, it was only to acknowledge what was already a fact. These men and women were Lady Patience's guard, paid by her when they were paid at all, but more important to them, valued and used by her, doctored by her when they were injured, and sharply defended by her acid tongue against any who spoke disparagingly of them. These were the foundation of her influence and the basis of the strength she came to wield. A tower seldom crumbles from the bottom up. She told more than one, and claimed to have the saying from Prince Chivalry. We had slept well, and our bellies were full. Without the need to hunt, we travelled the whole night. We stayed off the road and were far more cautious than we had previously been. But no forged ones did we encounter. A large white moon silvered us a path through the trees. We moved as one creature, scarcely even thinking, save to catalogue the scents we encountered and the sounds we heard. The icy determination that had seized me infected Night Eyes as well. I would not carelessly trumpet to him my intention, but we could think of it without focusing on it. It was a different sort of hunting urge, driven by a different sort of hunger. That night we walked the miles away beneath the moon's peering stare. There was a soldier's logic to it, a strategy Verity would have approved. Will knew I lived. I did not know if he would reveal that to the others of the coterie, or even Regal. I suspected he hungered to drain off my skill strength, as Justin and Serene had drained King Shrewd's. I suspected there would be an obscene ecstasy to such a theft of power, and that Will would wish to savor it alone. I was also fairly certain that he would search for me, determined to ferret me out no matter where I hid. He knew also that I was terrified of him. He would not expect me to come straight for him, determined to kill not only him in the coterie, but also Regal. My swift march toward Tradeford might be my best strategy for remaining hidden from him. Farrow's reputation is for being as open as Buck is craggy and wooded. That first dawn found us in an unfamiliar type of forest, more open and deciduous. We bedded down for the day in a birch copse, on a gentle hill overlooking open pasture. For the first time since the fight, I took off my shirt and by daylight examined my shoulder where the club had connected. It was black and blue, and painful if I tried to lift my arm above my head, but that was all. Minor. 3 years ago I would have thought it a serious injury. I would have bathed it in cold water and poulticed it with herbs to hasten its healing. Now, although it purpled my whole shoulder and twinged whenever I moved it, it was only a bruise, and I left it to heal on its own. I smiled wryly to myself as I put my shirt back on. Night Eyes was not patient as I looked at the slice in his shoulder. It was starting to close. As I pushed the hair back from the edges of the cut, he reached back suddenly and seized my wrist in his teeth, not roughly, but firmly.
"Let it alone. It will heal."
"There's dirt in it." He gave it a sniff and a thoughtful lick.
"Not that much."
"Let me look at it."
"You never just look, you poke."
"Then sit still and let me poke at it." He conceded, but not graciously. There were bits of grass stuck in it, and these had to be plucked loose. More than once he grabbed at my wrist. Finally, he rumbled at me in a way that let me know he'd had enough. I wasn't satisfied. He was barely tolerant of me putting some of Burridge's salve on it.
"You worry about these things too much,"
he informed me irritably. "I hate that you are injured because of me. It's not right. This isn't the sort of life a wolf should lead. You should not be alone, wandering from place to place. You should be with a pack, hunting your territory. Perhaps taking a mate some day."
"Some day is some day, and maybe it will be, or maybe it won't. This is a human thing, to worry about things that may or may not come to be. You can't eat the meat until you've killed it. Besides, I am not alone. We are together."
"That is true. We are together." I lay down beside Night Eyes to sleep. I thought of Molly. I resolutely put her out of my mind and tried to sleep. It was no good. I shifted about restlessly until Night Eyes growled, got up, stalked away from me, and lay down again. I sat up for a bit, staring down into a wooded valley. I knew I was close to a foolish decision. I refused to consider how completely foolish and reckless it was. I drew a breath, closed my eyes, and reached for Molly. I had dreaded I might find her in another man's arms. I had feared I would hear her speak of me with loathing. Instead, I could not find her at all. Time and again I centered my thoughts, summoned all my energies, and reached out for her. I was finally rewarded with a still image of Burridge thatching the roof of a cottage. He was shirtless, and the summer sun had darkened him to the color of polished wood. Sweat ran down the back of his neck. He glanced down at someone below him, and annoyance crossed his features.
"I know, my lady. You could do it yourself, thank you very much. I also know I have enough worries without fearing that both of you will tumble off here."
Somewhere I panted with effort, and became aware of my own body again. I pushed myself away and reached for Burridge. I would at least let him know that I lived. I managed to find him, but I saw him through a fog.
"Burridge!"
I called to him.
"Burridge, it's Fitz!"
But his mind was closed and locked to me. I could not catch even a glimmer of his thoughts. I damned my erratic skill ability and reached again into the swirling clouds. Verity stood before me, his arms crossed on his chest, shaking his head. His voice was no louder than a whisper of wind, and he stood so still I could scarcely see him. Yet I sensed he used great force to reach me. "Don't do this, boy," he warned me softly. "It will only hurt you." I was suddenly in a different place. He leaned with his back against a great slab of black stone, and his face was lined with weariness. Verity rubbed at his temples as if pained. "I should not be doing this either, but sometimes I so long for..." "Ah, well. Pay no mind. Know this, though. Some things are better not known, and the risks of skilling right now are too great. If I can feel you and find you, so can another. He'll attack you any way he can. Don't bring them to his attention. He would not scruple to use them against you. Give them up. To protect them." He suddenly seemed a bit stronger. He smiled bitterly. "I know what it means to do that, to give them up, to keep them safe. So did your father. You've the strength for it. Give it all up, boy. Just come to me. If you've still a mind to, come to me, and I'll show you what can be done." I awoke at midday. The full sunlight falling on my face had given me a headache, and I felt slightly shaky with it. I made a tiny fire, intending to brew some elf bark tea to steady myself. I forced myself to be sparing of my supply, using only one small piece of bark, and the rest nettles. I had not expected to need it so often. I suspected I should conserve it. I might need it after I faced Regal's coterie. Now there was an optimistic thought. Night Eyes opened his eyes to watch me for a bit, then dozed off again. I sat, sipping my bitter tea and staring out over the countryside. The bizarre dream had made me homesick for a place and time when people had cared for me. I had left all that behind me. Well, not entirely. I sat beside Night Eyes and rested a hand on the wolf's shoulder. He shuddered his coat at the touch. "Go to sleep," he told me grumpily. "You are all I have," I told him, full of melancholy. He yawned lazily. "And I am all you need. Now go to sleep. Sleeping is serious," he told me gravely. I smiled and stretched out again beside my wolf, one hand resting on his coat. He radiated the simple contentment of a full belly and sleeping in the warm sun. He was right. It was worth taking seriously. I closed my eyes and slept dreamlessly the rest of the day. In the days and nights that followed, the nature of the countryside changed to open forests interspersed with wide grassland. Orchards and grain fields surrounded the towns. Once, long ago, I had travelled through Faro. Then I had been with a caravan, and we had gone cross-country rather than following the river. I had been a confident young assassin on my way to an important murder. That trip had ended in my first real experience of Regal's treachery. I had barely survived it. Now, once more, I travelled across Faro, looking forward to a murder at my journey's end. But this time I went alone, and upriver. The man I would kill was my own uncle, and the killing was at my own behest. Sometimes I found that deeply satisfying. At other times, I found it frightening. I kept my promise to myself and avoided human company assiduously. We shadowed the road and the river, but when we came to towns, we skirted wide around them. This was more difficult than might be imagined in such open country. It had been one thing to circle about some buck hamlet tucked into a bend in the river and surrounded by deep woods. It is another to cross grain fields or slip through orchards and not rouse anyone's dogs or interest. To some extent, I could reassure dogs that we meant no harm. If the dogs were gullible. Most farm dogs have a suspicion of wolves that no amount of reassurances could calm. And older dogs were apt to look askance at any human travelling in a wolf's company. We were chased more than once. The wit might give me the ability to communicate with some animals, but it did not guarantee that I would be listened to, nor believed. Dogs are not stupid. Hunting in these open areas was different, too. Most of the small game was of the burrowing sort that lived in groups, and the larger animals simply outran us over the long, flat stretches of land. Time spent in hunting was time not spent travelling. Occasionally I found unguarded henhouses and slipped in quietly to steal eggs from the sleeping birds. I did not scruple to raid plums and cherries from the orchards we passed through. Our most fortuitous kill was an ignorant young harriger, one of the rangy swine that some of the nomadic folk herded as a food beast. Where this one had strayed from, we did not question. Fang and sword, we brought it down. I let Night Eyes gorge to his content that night, and then annoyed him by cutting the rest of the meat into strips and sheets, which I dried in the sun over a low fire. It took the better part of a day before I was satisfied. The fatty meat was dried enough to keep well, but in the days to follow, we travelled more swiftly for it. When game presented itself, we hunted and killed, but when it did not, we had the smoked harriger to fall back on. In this manner we followed the Buck River northwest. When we drew close to the substantial trading town of Terlake, we veered wide of it, and for a time, steered only by the stars. This was far more to Night Eye's liking, taking us over plains carpeted with dry, sedgy grasses at this time of year. We frequently saw herds in the distance, of cattle and sheep or goats, and infrequently, harriger. My contact with the nomadic folk who followed these herds was limited to glimpses of them on horseback, or the sight of their fires outlining the conical tents they favoured when they settled for a night or so. We were wolves again for those long, trotting nights. I had reverted once more, but I was aware of it, and told myself that as long as I was, it would do me little harm. In truth, I believe it did me good. Had I been travelling with another human, life would have been complicated. We would have discussed route and supplies and tactics once we arrived in Tradeford. But the wolf and I simply trotted along, night after night, and our existence was as simple as life could be. The comradeship between us grew deeper and deeper. The words of Black Rolf had sunk deep into me and given me much to think about. In some ways I had taken Night Eyes and the bond between us for granted. Once he had been a cub, but now he was my equal and my friend. Some say a dog or a horse, as if every one of them is like every other. I've heard a man call a mare he had owned for 7 years it, as if he was speaking of a chair. I've never understood that. One does not have to be witted to know the comradeship of a beast, and to know that the friendship of an animal is every bit as rich and complicated as that of a man or woman. Nosey had been a friendly, inquisitive, boyish dog when he was mine. Smithy had been tough and aggressive, inclined to bully anyone.